In recent years, a number of countries, among them places like Greece and Italy, Egypt, China, have demanded the return of antiquities held by museums around the world. Now, these governments say that these artifacts are state property, and in many cases, they charge that they are stolen goods. Our guest for this hour of the show, James Cuno, director of the Art Institute of Chicago, makes a different kind of argument. He says that antiquities need protection because they are the cultural property of the entire world. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Who Owns Antiquity? The subtitle, Museums and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage. It's published by the Princeton University Press, fairly recently published. As I mentioned, our guest is the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago. He has widely written on museums and cultural policy, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in with questions and comments is that they try to keep their comments brief so that we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep moving along. But, of course, people who are listening, they're welcome to join the conversation. If you are in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line so that if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, over the air, or you might be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cuno, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us again.
Oh, great pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it. This is something that now, apparently, in recent years, we have started to see more and more, that is governments around the world going to museums and saying, here, there are objects you have in your museum that was taken from our soil, maybe dug up from our soil at some time in the past. You have it in your collection, but we believe that this is ours, part of our national heritage, and so we are requesting that it be returned. That's starting to happen more and more?
Yes, certainly it is. It's coincident with a couple of phenomena. One is the, which are related, one is the rise in nationalism over the course of the 20th century, and the second is the rise in the number of cultural property laws, that is, laws that claim state ownership of antiquities or restrict the export of antiquities.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that this is, you write about this in the book, that it's something that concerns museums. So I suppose that certainly in any time that a museum is thinking about purchasing something, if there is any question at all about its provenance, that is, where it came from originally, who might have handled it, what the chain of ownership was, all of those circumstances. And apparently, if there's any doubt, now increasingly museums are just saying they don't want to have anything to do with that thing.
Well, these matters concern museums for a couple of reasons. One is precisely as you described, that is that no museum wants to risk its reputation by acquiring things it shouldn't acquire. It shouldn't acquire because it legally can't acquire them, and therefore it'll be likely that it will have to return them to the jurisdiction that has legal ownership of them, or because there will be the perception that the acquisition of these objects is contributing to the looting of the archaeological record. That's one respect. No museum wants to be seen in that position or to take that position. But the second reason it's of concern to museums is that museums, particularly those that I call encyclopedic museums, museums with representative collections of the world's diverse artistic legacy, are meant to offer the opportunity for people to see the truth of culture, which is that culture has always borne the imprint of its relationship to other cultures or its contact with other cultures, that it has never been national in the sense of the nation-state as we understand it today. It has never been limited by political borders, but it's always been something that has crossed borders and borne with it the influence of new inspiration, new cultural expressions. And we want people to be able to see that that is the truth of culture, and with that truth of culture comes the promise of greater understanding and appreciation of the differences and diversity among the world's cultures that actually hold the promise of, with those differences come a recognition of similarities.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you're making the argument that some of the countries that are concerned about their heritage, perhaps their concerns are as much political as anything else. But do you acknowledge the fact that, for example, in China, if we're talking about, and I know in your museum, for example, you have a wonderful collection of Chinese bronzes. These things were made in China. They were dug up and removed from China, maybe perfectly legitimately, but the Chinese would say, this is part of our national cultural heritage, and it would be all only fitting and proper for these to be in a museum in China. How would you evaluate that kind of claim?
Well, we would evaluate the claim on the basis of its legality. That is there evidence that laws were broken? And on those terms, we would make a judgment. We would not evaluate them on the grounds of identity claims or political claims, but rather make an argument to the contrary, which is that it's to the benefit of China, which is rising once again as a world's global power, that it be represented in the world outside of China, such that all of us have a regard for its history and for its great artistic achievements, so that when we come to deal with China as a political entity, we come with a great regard for its history and a deeper understanding of its people. That's the first point. The second point is, of course, Chinese don't only live in China. They live all around the world. They live here in Chicago, and increasingly they do and are moving around the world. And so we want to be able to provide not only non-Chinese access to what the Chinese claim is their culture, but also the Chinese who live outside of China.
So we're talking here not just about objects that might have been stolen or might have been acquired illegally, but also we're talking about things that might have been acquired illegally at the time that perhaps there weren't the laws regarding export of antiquities, or perhaps that they were indeed legally offered for purchase and someone bought it and they came to an American museum. We have countries that are making sweeping claims about material being returned, and you would make the argument that if we have something that, and you can establish the provenance and say, look, as far as the Art Institute, for example, or any other museum is concerned, this was legally acquired, then the idea of having this national claim shouldn't really have any standing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to analyze the nature of the claim itself. And in the case of the Chinese, for example, it's a part of the world with a glorious history, and China has increased in size and decreased in size over the course of time. It does feel as a nation, and by that I mean, of course, its ruling elite power. I don't mean every citizen of China, as diverse as they are, but nevertheless, the ruling elite in power feel that China has suffered indignities in the course of time, particularly in the last two centuries with opium wars, with foreign powers, the British and the French in particular, in the 19th century, with the civil wars and warlord years at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century, with the civil war that resulted in the nationalists of leaving China to Taiwan and taking with them a good portion of the treasures of the what is now the Forbidden City, called the Forbidden City, and all of that is a sign that they feel that they have lost some face and standing in the world, and now once again, as this rising military, political, economic power, they want to make a claim on things to restore that dignity they feel that they have lost. And so one can understand that claim, certainly. It's a legitimate and heartfelt claim. On the other hand, one can argue against that and say, look, that it is a claim on those grounds alone. It's not the claim, as said, which is to prevent the destruction of the archaeological record or the looting of archaeological sites, but rather it's a claim for political purposes, for standing in the world. And if that's the claim, make the claim on those grounds, let's talk about it on those terms, and we'll come to some agreement or not, or but at least we are having a conversation on the accurate terms, not on some inaccurate terms.
Yeah. And you did just touch on the fact that archaeological sites around the world, looting of archaeological sites around the world is a serious issue, that not only is valuable information lost because items are removed from the site, and so archaeologists don't have the opportunity to study the site as an entire site, but then also, of course, valuable material it's lost to that country, who knows where it goes. There have been certainly attempts around the world of law enforcement to deal with this issue, but it seems as if that hasn't it hasn't been as effective, certainly, as everyone would like. Why do you think that is the case?
Well, we should begin by saying that no one condones destruction of the archaeological record. The archaeological record is not a renewable resource, as people are fond of saying, and once destroyed, it is lost. That information is lost. So no one condones that activity. Everyone condemns that activity. And the discussion ought to be how best to preserve it and how best to share and broaden access to the results of those excavations. It's my argument that these laws and the international conventions that have been devised to supplement these national laws have not preserved the archaeological record. They've been in place increasingly over the last 50 years, and yet the archaeological record continues to be destroyed. So clearly the legalistic regime is not working, and the political regime is not working. There once was a time when another kind of practice was in place that seemed to work better, and that was a practice called partage, something that I write about in the book, which mm-hmm. is primarily at the end of the 19th century, first half of the 20th century, foreign excavating teams, whether they came from universities or from museums, came at the invitation of local authorities, under the jurisdiction of local authorities, excavated, brought expertise and financial resources to excavate, documented their finds, and then shared with the local authorities a portion of their finds. The local authorities had the first crack at the finds, and then they allowed the removal of a portion of the finds back to the organizing, sponsoring institutions, again, whether they be universities or museums, universities like the University of Chicago or the University of Pennsylvania, Harvard, Yale, British Museum, Metropolitan Museum, that sort of thing. That did three things, at least. One is it created local archaeological museums. The national museums of Iraq and Afghanistan and Egypt, for example, were founded on the basis of partage, on the finds shared with foreign excavators. Those that share the finds that remained in Iraq, Cairo, or Kabul, Baghdad, Cairo, or Kabul. The second thing it did was it brought the share of those finds back to host institutions, so they came back to universities where they were studied over the course of the intervening months between excavations, could be documented, could be published, that could be the basis of classwork and coursework that could educate additional archaeologists. The third thing they did is that they distributed the risk to those objects so that the risk was not concentrated in one place, and should calamity come to that place and those things destroyed, if those things had been shared as they were once shared under partage, the chance of there being a tremendous calamity would have been therefore reduced. Partage stopped, for all intents and purposes, at the middle part of the 20th century with, again, resurgent nationalism and the creation of nation states, and the imposition of these ownership laws and export restriction laws to the effect of concentrating risk in that one place. And we've seen the horrors of that with the calamities in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and the destruction of the museum in Baghdad and the museum in Kabul. And so I argue that the return of the principle of partage is more likely to achieve what we want, is excavation of sites and preservation of archaeological evidence and antiquities. And the third is broadening access to these for reasons of education, delight, and inspiration.
Mm. And yet it sounds as if today you would be saying that most governments are simply not interested in doing that.
Yeah, it's all but disappeared, partage. In exchange for this national sense of identity with ancient cultures, for reasons that I think are primarily, if not wholly, political. And because one can't easily draw a connection between the current political regime and the ancient regime, or between the current peoples and those ancient peoples, between the current culture and those ancient cultures. It is just by chance, for the most part, speaking quite generally, but just by chance that the modern nation-state occupies the same bit of land as those ancient civilizations, those ancient cultures.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is James Cuno. He is the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, has written on museums and cultural policy quite a bit, and is the author of a recently published book. The title is Who Owns Antiquity? The subtitle, Museums and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage, and it's published by the Princeton Press, University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I would expect that in hearing the argument for partage and the idea that by doing this you give more people an opportunity to see this material, it is preserved in multiple places, it's an opportunity for scholars to study it, and in making the argument for the Encyclopedic Museum, you would say that there might in fact be some advantage to see a number of different objects from different cultures all in one place. I suppose that some people would hear echoes of the kind of argument that I'm sure was offered by archaeologists and curators going back to the 19th and 20th centuries, in effect arguing that countries that had this material, the Near and the Far East, Africa, didn't know the value of what they had, and even if they did, weren't in any position to take care of it, and that what they were doing was they was making this argument that says we Europeans, maybe also we Americans, know better than you what this material is worth and how to take care of it, and so we're going to gather it up and we're going to take it back. We're going to take it to Europe. We're going to take it to the United States, and we'll take care of it for you. And I think that some people reacted very negatively to that, that it was demeaning of these countries and these cultures, and that it was in fact an example of an imperialist viewpoint.
Yeah, and I disagree with that, although people do say that, I think. But I think the historical origins of the notion of the Encyclopedic Museum lie in the Enlightenment, in the middle part of the 18th century, and in Britain, with an understanding that bringing together representative examples of the world's cultures serves as an instrument of civil society, that such museums are repositories of things dedicated to the dissemination of learning and to the museum's role as a force for understanding and tolerance and the dissipation of ignorance and superstition. I mean, those are the kinds of terms that were used in the 18th century. In the imperial misuse, let's say, of that noble premise in the 19th century is another matter. It's not and to argue against the premise is wrong, it seems to me. What one wants to do is to say if there is value in the idea of the Encyclopedic Museum to bringing people together to recognize the diversity of the world's cultures and the similarities and relationships and the truth of culture itself is always hybrid and mongrel and always overlapping and interrelated. If there's value in that because we get to see that the world is not just made of these singular and seemingly pure nationalist narratives, but really rather made of multiple narratives that overlap and complicate our simple and simplistic understanding of the world. If there's value in that, then we should find a way to encourage that experience everywhere in the world. I like to say that the fact that these museums, encyclopedic museums, happen to be in the northern hemisphere, they happen to be where the imprint of the Enlightenment was felt, that is in Anglo-Saxon countries and in France and in Russia, is not an argument against them, but it's an argument for their being elsewhere in the world. It's the same as with advanced medical science. I mean, to have advanced medicine limited or practiced primarily in the northern hemisphere is not an argument for there not being advanced medical science anywhere, but rather it's an argument for there being advanced medical science everywhere. And I think what we need to do is we need to focus our attention on the real issue in this matter, and that's the issue of an imbalance or an asymmetry in economic resources, in political stability, in military power, and find some way to address that asymmetry or that imbalance, not argue against the Encyclopedic Museum.
All right, let's talk with some callers here. We have someone to start off with in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Well, clearly this is a very problematic area, and the asymmetries power that you're, referring to certainly do, make it all the more problematic. But I'm curious to know, given what you're proposing here, how do you come down on the issue of American Indians and their attempts to reclaim not only their artifacts, but the restriction of archaeological work in their burial areas, things like that. I mean, we certainly have that issue here in the state of Illinois with the Cahokia Mounds, and I'm just curious, how you look at that.
Well, thank you. It's a very complicated and very important and interesting question. I would respond in two ways, I guess. In the first instance, that is with regard to the return of from museums to native people objects which are identified with their as relics, with their sacred rites, or with human remains. That is something that the U.S. government has addressed by legislation, and museums are in the process of returning such objects, for the obvious reason is that they continue to have a place in the living culture of these peoples. And that can't be said, for example, of matters related to pharaonic Egypt, that there is no living culture of pharaonic Egypt in the same way there is living culture of Native American peoples. It must also be said that we are striking this relationship with these peoples in great part because of the historical circumstances we have forced upon them as a governing authority, as a political entity, as a nation over the course of the last 200 years. So we're trying to redress some of the practices of the past by this means out of regard for their living culture and the circumstances we have imposed on them. The other question, I think, is much, much more complicated and problematic, and it is where science meets belief. And we saw that, we saw it with the Kennewick Man case in the state of Washington. It's a very difficult one that anthropologists are trying to sort out, and I'm afraid I don't have an answer for that. But it's, I come from another view of the world that would regard science, I suppose, more than belief on these terms, but it's reasonable that other people would have different views.
Well, see, but that's the whole thing. It's like you come from a particular viewpoint, but other people come from another viewpoint, and how do you, work that out without resorting to ultimately to an issue of who has more power? And, in many respects, that seems that the root of this problem.
No, I think you're right. I think that is the crux of the matter, and it's going to have to be, in every case, I'm sure, a mediated settlement. It won't be a legislated settlement or a juridical settlement, but a mediated one.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is in someone in Bement, line number two. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of, I'll take my answer off air. This is sort of associated. I collect coins and have dealt with Roman and Greek ones, and this has come up in the numismatic community where certain countries are claiming exactly the same thing. Cyprus in particular was a recent one, causing a great deal of consternation because the coins they're talking about were literally minted in millions over, say, 1,000 years, so it's not like they're rare or unusual, but caused quite a bit of a complexity, and I know from a museum standpoint, their collections or something, or their additions to their collections could be affected. What's going on in that field? And I'll take my answer off air. Thanks for talking.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Coins are complicated, as you just said, because of the numbers of them minted, and the fact that they circulated so widely, they were made for circulation, after all. So it's very hard to determine, often, you know, from where these things came in the most immediate sense. That said, coins can be very instructive if found, obviously, in archaeological contexts, and one doesn't want to encourage the disruption of those contexts. But once these things are out and about in the world, it is just, first of all, they're not going to be, that context won't be restored, they won't be returned to where they were found in any meaningful way, and so they're already alienated. Now what do we do with these things, and what can we learn from them as these alienated, undocumented objects? And we have to be very careful to decide and weigh the consequences of acquisition, and to weigh the risks of doing so. But much can be learned from these undocumented objects.
Other callers are certainly welcome. In fact, we have some others. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you feel that while on the one hand it sometimes seems that the problem here is between, and you write in the book that the problem sometimes seems to be between museums and archaeologists, because the archaeologists are concerned about things being, sites being disturbed and things being taken out of context and so forth. And you're arguing that really the big problem here increasingly is not that. It's between museums and national governments, who are, for political reasons, for nationalistic politics, are interested in repatriating objects that might be in museums around the world. And you said, well, if that's the case, well, let's be honest about it and have them say that's what it is, that's what it's about, and then we can talk. Well, then if a government actually was going to do that and said, all right, well, we'll be straight with you. You're the director of the Art Institute of Chicago. You have objects that were at one time in the past dug up from our soil, and we want them back. And yes, it's true that they're from our antiquity, and maybe it doesn't relate to current culture, but at the same time, we think this is part of our national heritage, and we want to have a national museum with this material. I mean, how does that make the conversation any easier if they're talking about you're giving back something that might have, say, been legitimately acquired, maybe under the principle, the partage principle that you outlined earlier, where it was dug up by archaeologists that were working with the permission of the government. They agreed that certain material would stay in the country and certain material could leave. And now someone's coming along and saying, well, we don't care what was agreed to in the past. This was taken from our soil and it belongs to us. And how does it make it any conversation any easier if you acknowledge right up front that it's about politics?
Well, I think that what that allows us to do is to talk about the matter from a common vantage point. That is, that now we both understand what we're talking about, and it's not as perhaps it might have been said in the past that this is really a legal claim, or that this is really about the preservation of the archaeological record, but it really is about what's meaningful to us, and what's meaningful to us in this country, country X, is that these things are objects with which we, from which we derive our identity, with which we imbue with great importance on the political and identity terms that we can articulate. And I say, yeah, but they're of value to me because these things allow us to better understand the achievements of these ancient peoples, and because they teach us a lot about the development of humankind over the course of hundreds, if not thousands of years, and so it's to our value to have them here. So what we have to do is to find some middle ground by which, if you want these particular things back for some particular reason, what is it then you can offer us so that we can achieve our purpose as well? How can we find some way to negotiate a relationship to our mutual benefit, so that some things that you want most are with you, but other things that you have can be shared with the world, and they can be shared with the world on a long-term basis? I don't mean just for a temporary three-month exhibition, but I mean something that's in our collections. Not that we necessarily have title to them. We can have them on loan, but they can be here for a very long period of time, decades, let's say, so that children can experience them over the course of multiple visits to a museum, over the course of their education in primary and secondary school, or because people can come back as adults, having seen them as children and see them differently. But they have a living relationship with these objects and their experience with these things. But in any case, I'm certain that if that these things are going to be resolved diplomatically, they're not going to be resolved legally, but they're going to be resolved diplomatically as a means of through the process of some kind of mediation and negotiation.
We have several other callers to talk with. Let's do that. Next in line is someone in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
When I was very young, early 20s, I happened to be in Toronto, and I was studying Chinese at the time, but just the language, not the culture, the history. And I went to the art museum there, and I remember being bowled over by the quality of this art. And then a few years later, I lived in Taiwan for a while, and of course went to the Palace Museum. Now, I wonder if perhaps the Chinese and the Greeks and so on might not be proud and happy to have evidence of their culture and their history like this on display in Canada and Europe and the United States. Is that a possible way of looking at it?
Well, I think that's precisely the way one could look at it, and perhaps one should look at it. And there's an example of this, and that's Japan. Japan has a very rational view, I think, of its of what it claims to be its cultural property. It ranks them in a hierarchy in which it determines from the highest national treasure a certain percentage of things, and then you know, a lesser national treasure, a national treasure, a cultural property. But it ranks them from, you know, the most important and rarest, most essential to Japan to the least important, least rarest, least essential to Japan. And it allows, with the exception of the very highest ranking, those others to circulate in the world. And then, for the reasons that you just articulate, and then it will also offer the means by which to conserve some of those things that are outside of Japan, elsewhere in the world, to be certain that they represent Japan well, that they are not being misused or being used to represent Japan poorly because they're in poor condition. So they have actually a governmental agency that conserves Japanese so-called cultural property outside of Japan, equally as they have a ministry that prevents the circulation from Japan, the export from Japan of a minority of things. So I think you're right. I mean, these things that are outside of the modern nation state can reflect well upon the modern nation state, not only to people who are not identified already with that nation state, but the people who are Chinese or who are Greeks, who are living in Champaign-Urbana, who are living in Chicago, living in Los Angeles, living in New Delhi, living in Johannesburg, wherever they might be, they also can feel the pride that local Greeks or Chinese feel about these objects when they are seen abroad.
Yeah, well, thanks. That makes sense to me. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two, another caller. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I think I would object to your assertion that it's more or less pure happenstance that these artifacts are found in a country today that has no close connection to the present population. It seems to me that in particular Egypt, but also in Iran and in Mesopotamia, the populations are descended from at least close relatives of the ancient populations. In Egypt and Iran, particularly Iran, the language spoken today is, modern Iranian is simply derived from the language spoken by Cyrus. And even in Egypt, there still is a small population of Coptic speakers, which was much larger not so long ago. It seems to me that in both cases, and in Mesopotamia, you can make the claim that there's a continuity, a continuous culture that has survived invasion and conquest.
Well, that might be true in languages, and you'll probably know much more than I about that, or much better than I. But I don't think that can be said of those objects themselves, or of the political, legal, religious, sacred context in which those objects had meaning. That the latter part of the 19th century, when Arab nationalism began to rise in the early part of the 20th century, began to rise in that part of the world. Of course, not in what was it, Persia, not in Iran, but elsewhere in Iraq and in Egypt. There was a recognition that the pre-Islamic world, of course, was of little interest because our identity derived from the Islamic world and the Islamic context. And so there was a clear division between the current modern context and the ancient context, and not a regard for of continuity. So it may be true in the language, it may even be true ethnically in some racial sense, but I'm certain that ethnicity and that those racial characteristics have changed over the course of time and are different today than they were thousands of years ago.
Well, you can make that claim for Europe, too. There wasn't a whole lot of interest in 16th century Europe for the antiquities of earlier Europeans, except where there was something like the alleged sword, the Excalibur, which the English, I believe, thought they had until it was lost in the quicksand when King John was trying to cross. Unless it was some connection to the royal lineage, there wasn't a great deal of interest.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's actually very important, that we liberate ourselves from this sense of seeking to legitimize our current position by means of some association with antiquity or the ancient world, that rather we ought to see ourselves not as continuing a kind of pure notion of static culture, but we ought to see ourselves as part of this larger world of negotiated, overlapping, hybrid cultures in which we all have a stake. It seems to me one of the big mistakes that nations make politically with this regard, and one can think of it right now with Afghanistan, because there's a very important and haunting exhibition of so-called hidden treasures of the Kabul Museum right now at the National Gallery in Washington. And these are objects that were in that museum and that were thought to have been lost when the museums were first destroyed by the Taliban and then subject to violence by the U.S.-led coalition forces in the war recently. But they weren't lost, at least many of them, and they were actually stored away in bank vaults by rather heroic individuals who took chances with their own lives to preserve these objects. And now they brought them back out, and they've been on view in Kabul, and now they're touring the world. And it seems to me there's a mistake in saying, as is said often about these objects in the press and even in the press releases generated by the Kabul Museum, that these things are representative of Afghan culture and that a nation survives only so long as its culture survives. That's one of the phrases that they use often with the Afghan and the Kabul Museum. And it seems to me that what that means is that why should we be so concerned about saving Afghan culture? Rather, politically, if they were to say, and particularly true in this case, because that part of the world was a great crossroads, as you well know, of exchange for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, through the central part of Asia, and we have those objects showing the confluence, really, of these cultural influences there at the center of the world, that we have a stake in the preservation of those antiquities, those objects, and in that state of Afghanistan, because it's got stewardship responsibilities for cultures that are representative of the world, not of the nation of Afghanistan.
I need to jump in here because we have only about 10 minutes left. I have some other callers. I want to thank the last caller for his comments and also for anyone who might have tuned in. Introduce again our guest. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is James Cuno. He's the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago. He has written widely on museums and cultural policy and is author of a book that explores this territory here that we're discussing. The title is Who Owns Antiquity? Museums and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage. It is published by the Princeton University Press. We have some other callers here to talk with, and we'll continue. And next, talk with someone in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hi. Your earlier comment, if I understand it correctly, you said that intervention by, say, the European culture indicates a certain amount of arrogance on our part. Yet let me point out two incidences One of them is the blowing up of the Buddha statues in Afghanistan, and the other is probably even worse than that, and that was the Spiro Mound incident in the United States. And the latter, of course, involved the private individuals where Spiro Mound was. They wouldn't allow archaeologists to go in there and do some controlled digging, and they absolutely raped the mound and took everything out of it. And then when they wanted to buy it back to give it to museums, they wouldn't do it, and they sold it by the roadside. And then, to top it off, after they were done, the archaeologists said, let us go in there and go through what you have left. And they refused to do that and took dynamite to it and blew it up. I'll take the comment off the air.
Well, thank you. I'm not familiar with the second example. It sounds like a tragic example, certainly. The first example, that of the Bamiyan Buddhas, is equally tragic and poignant. It was, as the story is well known, of course, the Taliban authorities decided that they were sacrilegious, effectively, these objects that they represented in the representation of the human figure, something contrary to Islamic law and rule, and so they had them destroyed. They had every right to do so, of course, because they were the sovereign authority of that nation-state at the time, and that's just precisely my argument, is that we ought to argue against nations having that kind of authority. We ought to argue instead of nations recognizing their international responsibilities of stewards of antiquity, and some have said of my suggestion or proposal that nations ought to see themselves this way, as these kinds of stewards, is that I shouldn't be in the position of being presumptuous, that I shouldn't be able to tell nation-states what they, or that we shouldn't, anyone shouldn't be able to tell nation-states what they can or cannot do with the antiquities and the cultural property that's within their jurisdiction. But that's precisely what we should be doing. We have a stake in all of this, and we should be using our diplomatic powers and means to seek the preservation and the broadening of access to these materials, because so much is at stake in our understanding, not just of the past, but who we are as human beings on this planet.
Well, again, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We'll continue and talk next with Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hello. Yeah. presumptuousness that you just talked about is perhaps precisely the basis on which many of the non-Western cultures have been interpreted by Western scholars, and so we presume that some of the aspects of the old cultures are no more reflected in the current culture. Iran, the other caller just pointed out, if you look at today's Iran, although it's an Islamic country, there are many, many aspects of Iranian culture that are rooted in the pre-Islamic era, and it would be presumptuous of us to assume that those aspects are dead, and therefore it's anyone's right to keep those antiquities. Instead, I would suggest that a system be established in which those respective countries are aided to preserve those antiquities in the right way, in the most scientific way, and that we contribute financially to that instead of bringing them over to us. I'll hang up and listen.
Well, thank you very much. That was a very important point that you just made, I think, about contributing financially to the preservation of antiquities wherever they might be. I would couple that with financial support for the sharing of those antiquities internationally. That is, that if there is a continuous link, and obviously, you know, a generalization is to say there is no continuous link, and I don't mean to make absolutely the remark that there is no continuous link, but let's say that there is some aspect of a relationship, continuous relationship between the ancient peoples and the modern peoples, however much there is discontinuity, continuity. Maybe there's some continuity. In any case, that's not an argument for those things, in my view. It's not an argument for those antiquities to remain within that jurisdiction of that nation state. In fact, it might be an argument for their being shared with the world because of what those objects can then tell us about the continuity of the culture of Iran or the peoples of Iran. And if they were shared with the world, it would be, to Iran's benefit. And if they are not shared with the world, I think that is not to Iran's benefit. It is, in fact, to make Iran seem foreign, distant, strange, inaccessible to us, and allows us to perpetuate myths about Iran that are dangerous to perpetuate, and that could be answered by our becoming more familiar with Iran. So it's really about preservation and access more than anything else, in my view.
All right. We have just a couple of minutes left. We do have some other callers. We'll try to get him in. Kane County, I believe, is next, line number two. Hello.
Champaign County.
Oh, Champaign County. Pardon me. Go ahead.
Let me propose an alternative, going back to the ancient Chinese treasures. The Chinese made a great occupation of forging ancient Chinese treasures. Keep the antiquities in their location. Use all of the technology available to make copies of accurate copies of those treasures to disseminate all over the world, not in one location where our kids can benefit from going back over and over again. Try to think of the importance of their kids going to see a treasure that was found locally.
Well, thank you very much. That's certainly a reasonable proposal. I guess I would distinguish between the authentic and the reproduced, the simulacrum with regard to the object and the power of that object. We're come to understand really the achievement of ancient peoples. It is from the original or the authentic object, not from the reproduction. But I agree with you that I'm not arguing that these things ought all to be in one place or another. I'm arguing that these things ought to be shared such that the experience of that authentic object can be valued not only by, let's say, the Chinese in the example that you used, but also by the non-Chinese everywhere else in the world.
We're coming down to the point where we almost have to finish. I guess I'm curious, at one point you talk about how it is over time the way that you think about these questions has changed. And so now, if you were in a situation where you were involved in making a decision about whether the museum would acquire something, and perhaps you thought that it was something that was very significant and that it would be a good addition to the collection, it would be a wonderful thing for you to be able to have on display, but there were some questions about its provenance, about where it came from. Would you now today be more hesitant to acquire that piece, or would you, even though its origins would be doubtful, that you would actually, if it's something that you thought was important enough, that wouldn't bother you?
Well, I think I might have said earlier in the program, it should be very, very difficult for us not to acquire, not to bring into the public domain an object of importance, an object of great beauty, an object of great rarity, of great fragility. And we ought to exhaust all efforts in investigating the sources of this object before we decide not to acquire it, indeed to acquire it. We're in the business of bringing objects into the public domain for their preservation and for the means of sharing them with the public at large. Not to bring them into them, as I said, to subject them to the vagaries of that unknown world of private ownership. And I'm unwilling to do that unless I'm obliged to do that because either I can't acquire it legally, I can't convince myself that I can acquire it legally, or the risk is too great, the gaps are too large in my knowledge about this object, and I'm putting, therefore, at risk the reputation of the museum, the financial resources of the museum, which, after all, in the end, are public resources. So I'd have to consider it very, very seriously on those terms alone, but they should be considered very seriously.
And should we be doing more? I asked the question knowing, obviously, you would say the answer was yes. Should we be doing more to prevent the looting and illegal sale of particularly of archaeological materials?
Yes, understood. I argue, therefore, in my book and earlier in this program again, for a means of both excavation and sharing of finds, and the retention of all such objects has caused the only alternative, which that alternative is a black market. And that black market has been fueled by the looting of archaeological sites, and it has fueled the further looting of archaeological sites because some people participate in the vagaries of the black market. When there was partage, it was less the case, and it could still be less the case if partage were to be restored.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, James Cuno. He is the president, director of the Art Institute of Chicago. His book is Who Owns Antiquity? Museums and the Battle Over Our Ancient Heritage, published by the Princeton University Press. Mr. Cuno, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. It was a great honor. Thanks again.